Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. The Mastermind of Brain Games returns tonight on National Geographic. This time, the series is Origins, the Journey of Humankind. Jason Silva joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. We'll explore another series return next half hour, that of actor Robbie Coltrane, playing a comedian accused of sexual abuse in National Treasure. Go behind Hulu's new original with executive producer George Ormond live from London. And there's one more TV return to spotlight today, Chef's Table, the innovative globe-spanning look at cuisine makers on Netflix. We'll connect with creator and executive producer David Gale next hour from Los Angeles. Also ahead, our Clapper trivia question this week, A Clapper Chronicle of Law is our show to know, and we say goodbye to a classic movie host, Robert Osborne. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More coming up in the program. Thank you for joining us on this Monday afternoon. It's the program All About Television, special 90-minute edition to kick off your week. We have some super guests on hand for you from all over the place, and we invite you, as always, to be part of the program. It's very simple. Just give us a ring, raise your voice, and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio. Our chat room is open as well, SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, as always, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Jason Silva will be live with us from the Big Apple after this news note. Robert Osborne, the veteran journalist of Hollywood Activity, who became the primetime host of Turner Classic Movies, has died. He was 84 and had taken a leave of absence from TCM last year to deal with an undisclosed health matter. The cause of his death at this hour is unknown. Before TCM began in 1994, Osborne was host on the Movie Channel, Showtime's Sister Pay Network. He was a regular on the Morning Program, an earlier CBS morning show hosted by Roland Smith and Marion Hartley, and the long-running rambling columnist at The Hollywood Reporter. In a statement released last hour, TCM General Manager Jennifer Dorian labeled Osborne's work, and I quote, fundamental in shaping TCM into what it is today, and we owe him a debt of gratitude that can never be repaid. We'll have more on Osborne's wonderful career later on in the program. If you'd like to offer your thoughts, either by call or chat room, please do so. We will put you on the air or offer your thoughts from the chat room. Our theme today, one way or another, is return. And our first guest case is the return to National Geographic, where he made his fame on television as the host of the groundbreaking series Brain Games. His newest work, Origins, The Journey of Humankind, premieres tonight. Joining me live here in New York, it's a pleasure to welcome back Jason Silva. Jason, welcome in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you celebrating the launch of Origins.
And talk about the launch of Origins. What made it happen? We first heard about it last year. I was around this time, and National Geographic had a special event here in New York for reporters. We caught some clips at the time. And it seems to be a far different cry from Brain Games. It's not about teasers that deal with interesting principles. This deals with actually like mileposts of human history.
Exactly. Yeah, we try to recreate and trace back these key origin moments that transformed humanity. We really look at these, as you said, milestones that change the game. So we have an episode on how fire was game-changing. We have an episode on transportation, moments, origin moments of transportation that changed the game. We have an episode on medicine. We have an episode on communication, how spoken language went from, you know, verbal utterances to all the way to the internet. So, again, we kind of take through a modern lens, we go back and we trace our origins, and we do that in a mixed format. We have the kind of nonfiction hosted element, which is my role as a sort of navigator, taking you on this journey, playing the Carl Sagan-esque role. And then we have these scripted sort of cinema-like, movie-like recreations of key moments in history that will be brought to life in an amazing way that is going to blow people's minds. So we mix formats to bring you a story of how man became modern.
How did you, as the host and your production team, come up with the subjects for Origin? What made them game changers enough that, okay, that's our subjects?
Yeah, well, we kind of isolated the things that make us unique. You know, we're not the only life on Earth. We're not the only intelligent life on Earth, but we're the only life forms that have incorporated non-biological props and scaffoldings with a sophistication that has actually changed our very biology. So we started using stone tools, and after a couple generations, our jaws physically shrank. We started cooking meals with fire, which essentially acted as an external artificial stomach that pre-digested our meals, that kept us full for longer and led to the development of culture and art. So in a way, cooking made us human. We have sophisticated symbolic language that allows us to collaborate and cooperate unlike any other species, really. You know, transportation, we, even though we're not a very efficient animal without our technology, with our technology, we're the most efficient animal there is. And so it's, again, like looking at the things that make us, that render us unique and dominant as a species.
Now, this is the latest effort by Nat Geo to do a hybrid scripted, unscripted series. The first one was Mars that came out last November, did very, very well, not just the United States,
correct,
but the world, and it is coming back for a second season.
Correct.
How does the formula work this time?
So you have, I work out of a studio, and I sort of play the storyteller. I sort of unpack the key ideas that every episode is going to explore. There's four acts in every episode. At the top of every act, it has me kind of doing my thing, setting everything up. And then we transition to these vignettes, which are the scripted storytelling component. We shot in South Africa for 75 days, real actors, amazingly high production value, cinema-like recreations. And then as those recreations are unfolding, I come in and out in little clips and or voiceover to navigate it along, but occasionally you're just there experiencing these moments as they happen. So we do hybridize the fiction and nonfiction components.
People who know you, Jason, know that you are a tremendous visual illustrator of concepts. You make things, and you show it beautifully on Brain Games, where you showcase even the toughest concept or the most minute detail in very good fashion. How closely did you work with your producers, your directors, and so forth to illustrate these various subjects, like fire?
Yeah, very closely. So this series was conceived by my very good friend, John Boswell, also known as Melody Sheep, who is a digital filmmaker who does insane visuals, and he's an amazing musical composer. He used to do the famous Symphony of Science videos. And he came up with this concept of this hybridized story of humanity, bring it to Nat Geo. Nat Geo got very excited about it, brought me on board, and me and John were friends. And so I worked very closely with the creators and the producers. In fact, I came on board as a consulting producer in addition to the host so that I could make sure that the elements that I was kind of hosting and sort of navigating were true to my own kind of style of expressing myself and my own flair for visual storytelling. So it really was a cooperative and collaborative endeavor, and I couldn't be happier with the results.
Jason Silva is the host of Origins, The Journey of Humankind. It's a journey that begins with its first episode tonight at 9 Eastern and Pacific Time on National Geographic, formerly known as National Geographic Channel. And Jason joins me live here in New York, where earlier today he was featured on Good Day New York. That's Channel 5, that's WNYW's local morning news show. And he's with us live from the Big Apple. This half hour on tomorrow will be televised. Simon Applebaum here with you live, also from the Apple, right here. And it's 41 degrees, by the way, at the top of the hour. Happy to have you aboard this Monday afternoon for the program All About Television. If you have a question or comment for Jason, ring it in, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple049. Remember, we come your way Mondays and Fridays at this hour here on Blog Talk Radio. And if you want to catch up on recent episodes, if you're a new listener to the program, we make it very easy for you. Just go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also check out our episodes on podcast via iTunes and Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. So in the case of the latter, you can both watch and hear us. If you don't have Apple TV, go to an Apple store near you, including the wonderful one at the former World Trade Center site and the PATH station in Lower Manhattan, or order it online. Jason, of all the topics you covered on Origins, what was the most fascinating one and maybe the most difficult one to showcase?
I'm extremely fascinated by the origin of communication and language. So many different theories about how, you know, really bright chimp-like or monkey-like creatures started creating symbolic language, which is what we did. I mean, how did we go from, you know, simple grunts and rudimentary cues and communication to the sophisticated symbolic reality that actually sculpted our brains? There's a lot of thinkers who have proposed that the emergence of language was the first transformative singularity and led to a kind of a Cambrian explosion of mind that wouldn't have been possible without language. I mean, if you draw a line in the sand and you have on one side early hominids pre-language and on the other side hominids post-language, that's the difference between imagination and no imagination. That's the difference between being able to conceive of really grandiose scenarios and planning and communicating those visions and cooperating and collaborating to bring those visions into life. And on the other side of that line, that would have been inconceivable. So without language, nothing happens. And how language came to be, you know, there's a lot of theories. One of the most controversial but also most intriguing is Terence McKenna's stoned ape hypothesis. He proposes that early humans inadvertently stumbled upon magic psychedelic fungi, ate those fungi, and found themselves experiencing synesthesia, which is one of the side effects of psychedelic experience. Synesthesia blends your senses together so that you see sounds and you hear sights, so to speak. And when you think about it, language is pretty synesthetic. Language encodes visual information, pictures, into vocal sounds and transmits them through time and space. So it's not that far-fetched to think that language might have been catalyzed by human beings hallucinating inadvertently. So it's very interesting to look at how this came to be, and I'm really excited about that episode.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about the work of John Boswell, one of the collaborators here. You mentioned that he provides a very unusual musical style. You call it symphonies throughout these
yes.
episodes. How does it show up, and how is it different from the use of music normally on programs like this?
Yeah, so the symphonies unpack the top of every episode. They're these three-minute-long, really anthemic, almost like a hybrid of a music video and a hosted segment. And I think what's amazing about it is that essentially they're standalone pieces of content. They're embedded in the show and they set up the top of every act, but they could live by themselves on the internet as like self-contained little nuggets of inspiration. I narrate them, and then the images are sprayed across the screen as I speak. And then he does this insane musical composition, and it just really feels like a trailer for the mind.
Yeah. Which one of the subjects challenged you the most in terms of that forced you, let's say, I may need to do more digging about this than I originally thought.
Yes.
You mentioned communication was one
yes.
that was fascinating.
Yeah.
Fire. Which one was it for you?
Yeah. I think the money one is fascinating. That author that's really popular right now, Yuval Harari, who wrote the book Sapiens, talks about the importance of kind of consensus imagination, how storytelling is crucial to humans, how fiction, believing in our own fiction, is crucial for cooperation that is beyond what's immediately in front of us. You know, in order to work together to build cathedrals and run societies, we need a symbolic reality. We need to believe our own fiction. And so he says that money only works if people believe in it. You know, modern money is not backed by gold anymore. And even if it was, you can't eat gold. Gold only has value because we say it does. And so the symbolic reality, the consensus required for financial transactions to work is fascinating. It's basically a virtual reality, and we need it in order to work together. So that's a really interesting thing that we delve into in the money episode. Another fascinating one and disturbing is the war. I don't like violence. I don't like war. But in the war episode, we look at all the ways in which the destruction of war led to incredible innovation and advancement. And so it's one of those like bittersweet realities, you know, that is sometimes uncomfortable to swallow.
And when you think innovation and war, I'm assuming it's not just weapons.
Yeah, it's not just weapons, but it's things that maybe at first were weapons and then turned something else. I mean, that the invention of the modern computer was trying to decrypt signals from the Nazis, intercept Nazi communications, which was explored recently in a feature film. But yeah, a lot of innovation came from military projects, things that we take for granted today, GPS, for example. So sometimes, you know, when human beings are pushed to the edges by existential risk, they come up with some pretty good ideas.
when you do a show like this, which blends the scripted vignettes with all the experts and you describing what's going on or elaborating on a point, how do you determine which experts go with what segment?
Well, there's a whole team, right? There's like writers, there's producers that work with the experts, and then there's TV people who are really good at making sure that something is edited so that it has a nice flow. And so, you know, they went back and forth a lot on the scripts, figuring out the right balance between me, between the vignettes, between the experts, so that we had a flow and we had an engagement throughout. So it's always, you know, like all creativity, you kind of figure out what works as you go, and a lot of it comes together in the editing room.
Was there a particular person that was interviewed that really sort of like tweaked your interest or you thought was going to go one way and turned out to be a whole different view?
You know what? From what I gather, some of the people involved are truly fascinating. I actually haven't been able to review all of the interviews that we've done yet because we've been back and forth on production and post-production. But I can tell you that they're going to be quite thought-provoking people that we have as part of it. And I'm very excited.
Origin, the story or the journey of humankind. It is the story of humankind, too, as a journey. It takes place starting tonight at 9:10 East Pacific Time on Nat Geographic, and Jason Silva, formerly of Brain Games, is the host. And he joins us live here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Tom Applegate will be live from New York to live your board this Monday afternoon right here on Blog Talk Radio. You have a question or comment for Jason? Don't be shy. Get in the conversation. You ring 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Remember, if you're in the New York area, we come your way usually on Monday afternoons between 12 and 1 on BK Live. It is the daily show about all things Brooklyn and beyond. You can catch it locally on what was Time Warner Cable, now Charter Spectrum, both in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Also Manhattan on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. Also on Verizon Fios TV throughout New York City. And in Brooklyn on Altice USA, formerly Cables and Systems, and RCN. And then the segments are posted the day after, or 2 days after at the most, at YouTube, at youtube.com/BrickTV. That's youtube.com/BrickTV. Coming up on today, we will have the folks behind Time, the Khalid Browder story, premiering its second episode this Wednesday night on Spike TV. And also a look at Feud, which premiered last night on FX. Great show. Wonderful opening title sequence, by the way, with music by Matt Quayle of Mr. Robot fame, who was on this program last year. I'll say this. I think this opening title is one of the very best to come out this year. It may be the front runner for the Emmys in that category, both for title design and for title music. Jason, do you feel for people saying bring Brain Games back?
Say again?
Do you still hear from people saying, I love Brain Games, I wish we could get back on Nat Geo?
Yes. Brain Games has developed a global fan base that still ravenously consumes even the reruns. And it's been really gratifying to see how much people got out of that show. And people do ask if we're bringing it back. And I tell people, you know, check out Origin. It's really going to blow your mind, because with Brain Games, we showed you how your brain perceives the world. With Origins, we show you how the world came to be. And I think they're definitely related in that sense. And I hope people kind of see Origins as a nice next sequels for me, you know?
And both are ground, in their way, are examples of groundbreaking television. And if there's one thing people can say about you, Jason, it's that you are attracted to groundbreaking TV. What is it about you, about your style, your personality, that sort of says, this is the kind of television I want to do?
Well, I'm in an interesting space, right? Because TV is going through a golden age with, like, long-form scripted dramas that are doing so well on TV and on avenues like Netflix. But in terms of nonfiction, you know, you had the age of the reality show, and traditional sort of nonfiction needs to be disrupted as well. And I think that with shows like this and with Brain Games, we're trying to create our own little revolution in the nonfiction space. How do you make docu-content that has the engrossing quality of a scripted drama? How do you have content that is immersive without being fictitious? And this is a challenge. It is a space where I live, so I'm definitely drawn to projects that try to play in that space.
Now, you are going to be in a couple of weeks back here in New York to do Live with Kelly Ripa.
Yes.
Any idea if you're going to do a Brain Game with her or something you know, totally different aside from, of course, you know, showcasing more about Origins.
Yeah, that's an interesting opportunity. So, as you know, she has a lot of co-hosts these days, and I was invited to come be a co-host with her for the day on March 15th. And I was told that the producers were fans of some of my videos on the internet, and that they showed her my stuff and she wanted to bring me on board. And that was before they even knew about Origins. So I think it's going to be a great opportunity to promote Origins, but I also think it's just kind of be a chance for me to just kind of be her co-host for the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far she's had great luck with the co-hosts. No matter who they are, she always gives them a great environment to work on and work with.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like she's got a flair for it. So I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a nice, you know, to be an hour on live TV with no real structure should be interesting. The first 20 minutes of that show is just her hanging with the guests. So it should be interesting.
And that's amazing. Before we had a lot of shows try that format on different kinds with the idea of the first 20 minutes, 15 minutes being live, or just first 15 minutes, 20 minutes without commercial break. That's really something to do. That's really something to master, the idea of keeping a conversation going with audience response for that length of time. Plus you have the contest,
agreed.
Plus you have, you know, whatever is in the news that to help you out.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely a challenge I'm looking forward to, for sure.
What is next for you in television, Jason? Another season of Origins, a new project for Nat Geo or somewhere else? Where do you go from here?
You know what? I'm looking forward to taking a bit of a rest now that Origins comes out with all the press and all the stuff. It's going to be a bit crazy for the next 2 weeks, and then I'll take a vacation and sit for a minute and see how that does, and then we'll see. You know, I've never really had a plan, but I've always had a compass. So I kind of go with where the pull is.
Well, let's say Origins gets a second year at Nat Geo, the way the Mars has already gotten it, which I believe the second season will be running this fall. Is there a milepost, a subject that you couldn't get in this first set of episodes that you definitely will get in for a second?
I would be very curious to look at the origins of the human relationship with altered states of consciousness. So if you look at every culture has some kind of initiation experience that requires ecstasis, whether it's indigenous cultures with their shamanic ceremonies, whether it's the ancient Greeks with their ecstasis, whether it's contemporary rave culture or Burning Man, you know, these pilgrimages and these extreme alterations in brain chemistry that allow people to transcend their usual perception is something that humans have done forever. There's a book by a pharmacologist called Ronald Siegel called Intoxication, Life in Pursuit of Artificial Paradise, in which he argues that the drive to alter our perceptions is as natural as the drive for sex and food. So that would be cool to look at.
Speaking of pilgrimages, Jason, you should connect with Morgan Freeman because he did the series The Story of God for Nat Geo the last two seasons, and it deals with him going to various corners of the earth to sort of ask some interesting questions about God, from reincarnation to how you deal with life, eternal life, how you deal with, et cetera, et cetera. And so maybe there's something for you. Incidentally, before I let you go, given that this is your first encounter with scripted television, and scripted is one of the big things these days all over the place, do you see yourself maybe in the world with a fully scripted show at some point?
That has not really crossed my mind. I've never really been one to be able to pretend the camera's not there. And what I mean by that is that in the nonfiction space, you incorporate the camera, the viewer. You know, everything is cards are on the table. When actors, and I'm fascinated, I love movies, I love what actors do, but their capacity to be real while pretending they're not being watched, that's kind of amazing. I don't know how they do it.
Did you see some of the films that were very speculative that came out late last year, like Arrival and Passengers and, you know, films like that?
Yeah, Arrival was my favorite by far. I thought that was a magnificent film, a thinking man's science fiction, my favorite.
Well, if you miss Brain Games, Give Origins a try. I think you will like what Jason does, and I think you will like what comes out of that program. It is very, very unique. And it all kicks off tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, Origins, The Journey of Humankind on National Geographic. Check your local listings for the place where Nat Geo appears in your area on cable and satellite. And for more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.natgeo.com. That's www.natgeo.com. That's Origins, The Journey of Humankind. Check out Jason's web videos if you haven't. He's a master communicator. He takes any topic under the sun, makes it visually great, and stimulates your brain in all sorts of wonderful ways. Jason, a pleasure to have you back on the program. Congratulations on Origins. I hope it becomes a long-running show, and all the very best with tonight's premiere and beyond.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome, 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 Jason. All the greatest. Enjoy your time here in New York. And best luck, by the way, with Kelly on March 15th. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jason Silva, the host of Origins, The Journey of Humankind, tonight at 9 on Nat Geo, joining us live here in New York. Our topic trivia question of the week comes your way after some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. One of the big TV attractions coming up next month is the long-awaited version of the novel The Handmaid's Tale with Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men and a wonderful cast, which will be premiering on Hulu in late April. But you don't have to wait to check it out. You can have a wonderful sound experience thanks to Audible.com because The Handmaid's Tale is in a fantastic audiobook narrated by the star of Homeland, Claire Danes. And you can get it if you subscribe for a 30-day trial to Audible.com. Audible.com is a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. Over 180,000 titles to choose from at any time, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. Remember, you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. audibletrial.com/televised. You get one free audiobook like The Handmaid's Tale and a 1-month trial of the service. And the service is top of the line because Audible is headed by Amazon.com, one of the great providers of customer service across the globe. So hear for yourself why great audiobooks make great sound gifts for you, your family, and others. Check out a free audiobook, 1-month trial, great customer service, all super package at audible.com. Remember, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/televised. audibletrial.com/televised. Sign up for a sound experience that can transform your life. audible.com, an Amazon company. And now it's time for our Classic Trivia Question of the Week. We'll pose the question. If you know the answer, email me at simonapple04@yahoo.com. And if you're first with the correct answer, you can win Lucille Ball FAQ, the latest in the popular FAQ series about all things television from Applause Books. One of the great mystery characters of all time is Nero Wolfe, created by Rex Stout in novels, novelettes, short stories. Well, he's had an interesting TV career. 5 actors have played Nero Wolfe one way or the other on television. In made-for-TV movies, in a series or two, one that was on NBC, one that was on A&E, a pilot, and, believe it or not, a movie. Here's our question. Name one of those 5 actors who played Nero Wolfe on television. That's American television. Name one of those 5 actors who played Nero Wolfe on American television. If you know the answer, or at least one of them, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to close your name and your full mailing address, and if you are first with the correct answer, you can win Applause Books' wonderful title, Lucille Ball FAQ, about one of the great people on and off the TV screen. Of course, the star of I Love Lucy, and behind the scenes, the co-founder with her then-husband, Desi Arnaz of Desilu, one of the great all-time independent production companies, and really set the mold for many, many more to follow in TV history. Lucille Ball FAQ, published by Applause Books and Cinema, can be yours if you are first with the correct answer. Once again, simonapple04@yahoo.com. As soon as you get in, soon you have an opportunity to win. And if you just missed the question a moment ago, don't worry, I'll post it tomorrow morning on my Facebook page and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, in order to win, play in, and all the very best. This is Tomorrow Be Televised, the program all about the two. We're with you Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. We don't have guests yet set for Friday, but we're working on it all week long. So stay in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter, and we'll let you know who they are. One possibility for Friday, incidentally, is somebody that we are rescheduling, and that is Leslie Grief, the executive producer of the hit new CMT miniseries Sun Records, based on the Broadway hit Million Dollar Quartet, about Sun Records bringing together Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and other top talents. We hope to, keep your fingers crossed, have Leslie on the program Friday afternoon. The 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow will be televised. Remember, we love hearing from you. What do you think about our programs? What do you think about the world of television? Where it's at, where it's going? Let us know. And you can email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. You can find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, what you say matters. We come back in our Show You Know segment, a true classic of television, The Defenders, now available in great shape on YouTube. But first, we go live to London. We speak with the executive producer of Hulu's new critically acclaimed original drama, National Treasure, starring Robbie Coltrane in a return television. We will have George live from London after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's an open the Key Indiana Plug Show. Check out Key Indiana Crew tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the Bobby Televised 90-minute edition coming your way, second half hour of it at this moment. The live view are aboard, 41 degrees at the top of the hour. Remember, if you have a question or comment for our guests ahead, or if you want to pay tribute to Robert Osborne, the Turner Classic Movies host who passed away earlier today, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Our theme today is return in one way or another. And our second segment today deals with the return of an actor from Scotland named Robbie Coltrane, who has done a lot of great work on British television, but made his mark on American television in the mid-1980s in a wonderful series called Cracker, where he played a brilliant crime psychologist who had a lot of trouble getting his own life in order. The series ran 3 seasons here in the States on A&E, also was something of a made-for-TV movie about a decade ago. And now Mr. Coltrane is back in a brand-new series called National Treasure. It's a 4-parter, and it deals with one half of a comedy team who gets involved in an incident of sexual abuse. Maybe? Did he do it? Did he not do it? That is the rub. The series recently premiered on Hulu. Joining us live from London, another internet radio exclusive, executive producer George Ormond. George, great to have you with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure. George, how did National Treasure get going, and how did Robbie get back into television through it?
We developed the show with Jack Thorne, our writer, and he, right from the very beginning, knew that he wanted to write about a comedian who was part of a double act. He had a very clear idea of the story that he wanted to tell with it. And we thought of Robbie very early on in the process. And we took the script to Robbie, and he responded immediately, and we were absolutely thrilled that he wanted to do it.
For those who didn't see Cracker in the 1980s, I did. It was a wonderful series. One of the best mystery characters I think ever made for television anywhere, you know, U.S., Canada, England, anywhere in the world. And Coltrane brought so much heart and so much complexity and shades of gray to the character. How do you approach the idea of playing someone who is, at the least at the beginning, he's a beloved comedian, as noted, the National Treasure, who ends up in an investigation over whether or not he sexually abused a minor?
Do you mean how did we approach it, or how did Robbie approach it?
Both. Actually, both.
Well, we were very clear when Jack was writing and we were looking for our pool that we wanted somebody who the audience would love. And we felt Robbie brought absolutely that presence, that charisma, that warmth. It's quite hard, I think, when you're casting a role that the audience have to believe is a comedian who's, you know, been loved by his audience for years and has been on telly for years and has been sort of in the corner of your living room for years and is familiar as those sitcom stars are. We wanted somebody who had that sort of resonance with the audience, and we felt Robbie had it. We also felt that he would bring the nuance and the subtlety and all that range that you talked about him bringing to Cracker to the role. And so, I mean, I guess one of our hopes for the show was that it would confuse the audience in terms of how they might feel about Paul, that here's a man who's very charismatic, who you ought to feel a lot of affection for, who is being accused of something terrible, and that your sympathies swing all the way through the show as you don't know whether what he's been accused of is true or not, and you gradually peel the layers back on him and his family as the show progresses. And I think one of the successes of Jack's script and of Mark's direction and of Robbie's performance is that the needle of your sympathy swings from one way to the other all the way across the series. And in, you know, at certain points in certain episodes, you think he's guilty, and then half an hour later, you think he's not, he's innocent. And you're constantly interrogating that relationship you have with him. And in terms of Robbie's approach, I think he was meticulous. Mark Munden, our director, rehearsed very thoroughly with all of the cast, and Robbie was incredibly committed, and he brings real, he's just a wonderful actor. He brings real insight and detail and nuance to all of his scenes. So, yeah, he was great.
I've heard that this miniseries is based on an actual investigation that happened sometime back.
No, it's completely fictional. So it's not based on any specific investigation, but it was inspired by, and I guess a response to, a whole swathe of cases that came out after, I don't know how much you know about this in the States, but Jimmy Savile was big TV personality over here, and after he died, it came out that he'd abused a huge number of people, and in the fallout from that, there was a massive increase in the number of accusations against all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds, but particularly public figures in the world of TV. So suddenly, celebrities, comedians, actors, all sorts of, you know, DJs, all, you know, people were being accused of historic sexual offences, and it felt very current. And it was a real shock for everybody in the UK to find all these people who were, you know, I grew up watching some of these people on TV, and suddenly they're being arrested, and you think, you know, you think they're one thing, and then actually they seem to be another thing. And then some of those people who were arrested were cleared, and some of those people were convicted. So that was what the show was responding to and interrogating. But the story of Paul and Paul's family is entirely fictional, and we were very, very careful to... We really wanted it to be fictional because it gave Jack the freedom to create a family that he could explore with his own stories running through it, and give him the freedom to explore all of the issues around the subject matter.
George, for those who don't know, Jimmy was the host, I believe, of Top of the Pops, which was one of the great BBC pop music shows, long-running, practically... I believe since like late 50s, early 60s, practically every major musical group in America, the world, showed up on that program one time or another. And like I said, this person was probably one of the most beloved BBC on-air talents ever. And then Scott comes crumbling down with the revelations that happened in the last year or so.
That's correct, yeah. And he was not only, he presented Top of the Pops, he also had a show called Jim Will Fix It, which was a kids show, in which he arranged for kids to, you know, kids wrote in and said, I would really love to do this. I'd love to go on a roller coaster. I'd love to go on a trip. So I really want to do something really special. And he would arrange it. And I grew up watching that show. And he was absolutely, he was a saint, actually, in the public eye. And then there was a massive shock when it came out what he'd been doing all his life.
George Armand is executive producer with George Faber of National Treasures, the four-part miniseries currently running on smart TV sets and smart TV devices here in America via Hulu. And George joins us live from London this half hour right here on Tomorrow We Tell. We thank him for taking out his prime time, part of it, to be with us on this late afternoon here in the States. Tom Applebaum coming to you live from New York here on Blog Talk Radio. Great to have you with us for the program All About Television. Now it's 10th year on the air. You have a question or comment for George, don't be shy. Make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. In case you missed the news at the top of this hour, Robert Osborne, the former personality of Turner Classic Movies, passed away earlier today. We'll repeat that news note at the top of this hour. And if you were a fan of Turner Classic Movies, you want to pay tribute to Mr. Osborne, give us that call or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, and we'll put you on the air or get your comment read on the air. We do appreciate it. A lot of people thought that when Robbie did Cracker, that it was a very fearless performance and a very like high wire performance. How fearless of an actor is Coltrane?
He's pretty fearless, I think. I mean, to take on a role like this and attack it in the way that he does, I think takes a lot of bravery. I mean, it's he's pretty. Yeah, I think his choices throughout the show are brave, and he's not at all, you know, none of his choices are informed by vanity or, you know, anything like that. He absolutely took his character to all the places that we wanted the character to go to, and was not at all scared of that. He may have been scared of it, but he did it anyway. I mean, I thought he was very brave in lots of moments throughout the show. He really went for it. It was great.
Talk a little bit about how the writer Jack Thorne depicts television in this miniseries. And I ask because recently I had the chance to revisit one of my favorite films of recent years that I first saw on Turner Classic Movies, A Face in the Crowd, directed by Elia Kazan, with Andy Griffith's incredible performance playing Lonesome Rhodes, a hick singer, commentator. He gets discovered by Patricia Neal's character. He then has an incredible rise to national stardom, and then he basically, because of his personality, because of his actions, it all comes crumbling down on him. And one of the things, the fascinating thing about that movie was how it showcased television, how it showcased radio, and how, in a way, the environment of the medium transformed Rhodes, transformed Griffith's character into this larger-than-life, almost, in a way, demonic character. So how did your writer treat the world of television? How does it come across? And how does it shape the character in National Treasure?
I think it's absolutely central to the character, and it's central to what Jack was writing about. I mean, I was saying earlier, he was very drawn to the idea of Paul being a comedian and being one half of a double act. And so in terms of how it affects the character, I think he was very interested in the fact that comedians elicit a sort of affection from the audience. They have apparently a very direct relationship with the audience. We feel like we know them because they are apparently being who they are on screen. And comedy is a world that Jack knows pretty well, and he felt it's a very competitive world. And it's a world in which comedians have a public persona that they're constantly presenting to their audience, but there is something in them in Paul in particular, that is, you know, craving attention, seeking affection from the audience, and that was, I guess, the starting point for writing this man and his relationship with himself, and it informed everything about him and how his relationship with his double act partner Carl, played by Tim McInerney, and how he felt that his comedy partner had always been a little bit more successful than him, and how that, you know, all of that stuff came through. I mean, I think so that was all central to who Paul is and what makes Paul the man he is, and why he has such a complicated relationship with himself and his family. I think he was very interested in the distorting lens of celebrity and how that informs how you see yourself and your relationship with other people, and how it gives you power, and how that power gives you a sort of imbalance in the relationships you have with other people. And then I think, I mean, Jack has he loves the world of TV, and so there's a lot of affection there as well. I guess the other thing is, you know, setting the story in the glare of, you know, the public eye, with the media spotlight shining on it, and trying to bring that world to life was something that we worked very hard at. So not just having the journalists gathering around the door and that kind of thing, but, you know, the world that Paul operates in, which starts off loving him and then very quickly shuns him as the accusations come rolling in. And soon enough, he is being interviewed, for instance, on the Victoria Derbyshire show. Victoria is an interviewer for the BBC. So, you know, we try to blur the boundaries a bit by having real comedians and real TV personalities drifting in and out of our story, but, you know, always at the sidelines to create this TV world that felt real without being too arch, and I guess infused the whole story with a sense of, you know, rooting it in that world.
And the comedy world, which actually influenced a lot of British television throughout the decades, whether it was, you know, comedian comedy teams like Eric McCampion, Ernie Wise, or Dave Allen, or Benny Hill, who have sort of a music hall tradition, let's say, as opposed to comedians like Jack Benny and Bob Hope, who were basically stand-up and became film stars. Mm. Bob Monkhouse, who was a stand-up comedian that became an all-around performer, one of the best game show hosts, maybe the game show host of British television. How did that influence the way that the, not just the script went, but the actual filming of your series?
Well, we had to decide what kind of show that Paul and Carl had together. You know, what kind of comedians they were, and they Jack wanted them to be very much that sort of music hall tradition double act, and he wanted them to have had a series of sitcoms that were very much in that traditional mold. So he created a fictional sitcom called Japes, which was one of the ones that we actually shot scenes from. And you see those scenes as part of, as you get deeper into the story, in episode two, you see them as performers operating around each other and you know, on set of this sitcom filming in the 1980s. And I guess that's partly because those sitcoms, there's an innocence to them. And, you know, when we grew up watching them, they're very, again, they trigger a sort of affectionate response in the audience. And we feel familiar with that sort of Dad's Army type, or Morecambe and Wise, or, you know, any of those double acts. So that was what we were going for in terms of the backstory and the sitcom. And then in terms of, I guess, the present day story, Jack always had the sense that Carl and Paul would bounce off each other, and they might slip into a bit of their old routine. But apart from that, it was really, you know, these are two characters who have drifted apart in a way. They're very old friends. They're incredibly close. They've spent most of their life together. But Carl has then slightly overtaken Paul and has gone into straight acting and has won more accolades than Paul. And so there's a little bit of jealousy between them as well, Paul being jealous of Carl. So there's a really interesting, chewy relationship between the two of them.
National Treasure, the acclaimed four-part miniseries from England, now running on Hulu, is available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices like Roku, Apple TV, Google Chromecast, etc., etc., etc. We have George Roman, one of the executive producers of the series. He's live with us from London, where it's now coming up on 9 p.m. local time, as we're coming up on 4 p.m. local time here in the U.S. of A. Happy to have you with us for this edition of the program about television. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York, 41 degrees at the top of the hour. And if you have a question or comment for George, ring it in, 64. 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04MM. And coming up, I'll have a show to know, which is a classic, one of the great classics of the 1960s, The Defenders, now available, at least the first season, on YouTube, and it is must-see viewing. George, another famous actor who is involved in the series is Julie Walters. I'm sure a lot of people remember her from the film that she won the Oscar nomination for. She played it on Broadway. She played it in local theater before transferred to film. What did she do in this series, and what was it like to work with her?
So Julie plays Mari. Mari is Paul's wife, who they have been together since they were childhood sweethearts. So 40 years they've been together. And as you go through the series, you discover that they've got a really, really interesting relationship, which is very, very affectionate. There's a lot of love between them. But as you get into the series, you realize that Paul hasn't been faithful throughout their relationship, and Mari knows about it. And they've got a sort of deal between themselves, which is that she knew that he wouldn't be faithful. And as long as he was honest every time it happened, that was their arrangement. And it's a really, I mean, Mari's story through the four episodes is really fantastic, really emotional, really, you know, and Judy, I think she, her performance is absolutely incredible. I mean, she was wonderful to work with, like Robbie, very committed, that, you know, they rehearsed really, really thoroughly, and you know, Jack writes these very long scenes. There are a couple of, you know, standout scenes across the series. You know, there's an 8-page scene in episode one, and there's a massive scene between Mari and Dee, Andrea Riseborough's character. So Mari is mum, and Dee is her daughter in episode two, and Julie's performance is phenomenal, and I haven't seen her be that fierce before, and it was a real. Again, she's an actor who we in the UK have huge affection for, and I think the audience come to her thinking she's really lovely, and she is really lovely in real life. But in this particular scene, she really bares her teeth. She really kind of rips into her daughter, and it's really, you know, as the pressure comes down on the family and they all start to respond to it, it's really interesting watching it unfold. She was, you know, truly fantastic and a joy to work with.
You've gotten, I understand, some early feedback from people who have watched the show here in the U.S. on Hulu. What are people telling you here about your work?
The response from viewings in the States? Well, it sounds very positive, and it's been really nice to have such a positive reaction. I've read some of the reviews, which have been really lovely. So it's very exciting for us.
George, before we go, what's next for you? Any TV projects on the horizon you'll executive produce or produce?
I am working on a show that's filming at the moment for Channel 4 in the UK, which is set in a school. And that's, we're halfway through filming at the moment, so we've got 5 weeks to go, and that's the project that's keeping me busy at the moment.
That's good. I hope it comes to the United States, too, in some way or another. Right now, one of Channel 4's best of recent years, Humans, is now in season two on AMC in the States. We had Jonathan Blackman and Sam Vincent, the wonderful creators of that show, working with Channel 4 and Kudos on a couple weeks ago. That show is picking up exactly where I left off 2 years ago. Wonderful series. One of the best, I think, dealing with the whole subject of alien beings, synthetic beings, and who's more human, the synths or the human beings? It really is an amazing show.
It's a great show. I love it. I've watched every episode.
And Channel 4, one of the best producers of quality, innovative, groundbreaking television. And I'm thrilled that they are involved with you on another project coming up. Looking forward to hearing more about it. Hopefully not too far away from now. In the meantime, National Treasure is playing on Hulu. Remember, it is playing on smart TV sets and smart TV devices like Roku, Apple TV, NVIDIA Shield, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And most smart TV set makers, of course, have Hulu as well. If you want more information about the series and Hulu, go online to www.hulu.com. That's www.hulu.com. National Treasure, starring Robbie Coltrane, Julie Walters, Tom McInerney, also Andrew Risboro. Really super cast, really super tale, and one definitely worth your time. George Rowland, the executive producer of the program, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on the series, and look forward to having you back on this program with another TV project. It's been a pleasure to have you aboard.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome, George. All the greatest. Take care. Have a wonderful night out there.
Thank you. Bye.
George Owen, executive producer of National Treasure, joining us live from London. And now it's time for our regular feature, Show to Know, where we highlight a program that you may not know about, and it's worth your while, worth your watching, and you may not know about it because it's usually not well marketed, promoted, publicized, et cetera, et cetera. Or both on the radar screen of journalists and pundits covering the medium. In recent times, we have had shows to know that are classics, and this one is a classic, one of the great classics. Talked about it earlier today on DK Live, and it's now available in beautiful shape on YouTube. It's The Defenders. We ran from 1961 to 1965 on CBS. It won many Emmy Awards along the way for show, for writing, for directing, and for acting. And it's a program that was one of the first to deal with the law and some controversial aspects about it. Speaking of Fearless, this program, created by Reginald Rose, who made the classic drama 12 Angry Men, both the TV version and the film version starring Henry Fonda, and directed and produced by Herbert Brodkin, who later did one of the best miniseries ever, Holocaust. This show, produced in New York, one of the last to be done in New York in a major way, is outstanding. And it was a show that was fearless to tackle topics that had not been discussed on television before. The first episode, in fact, dealt with a mercy killing, the killing of a mongoloid child just born. It also dealt with abortion, the blacklist, civil rights, racism, you name the subject, coming to grips with the time in the 1960s, The Defenders dealt with it. And it dealt with it in uncompromising ways and beautiful performances, playing a father and son lawyer team, E.G. Marshall as the father and Robert Reed as the son. For those of you thinking that Robert Reed was just Mike Brady on the Brady Bunch, you are in for a revelation here. He's a wonderful actor, and this was his breakthrough performance in television. As I mentioned, the show ran for four seasons, had wonderful writers like Ernest Kenoy, and had great directors who later made their mark in films like Franklin Schnapper with Patton, Paul Bogart, who later went on to do a great role with All in the Family, did movies as well, and Stuart Rosenberg, who later did a wonderful film with Paul Newman called Cool Hand Luke. The music score is by Leonard Rosenman, one of the great fanfares of all time. The photographer Morris Hartspan is terrific. Film editing outstanding. Every which way you slice it, The Defenders is magnificent television. And I'm happy to say that you can now catch the first season on YouTube. Just go to The Defenders and then the episode number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I binge-watched a bunch of the episodes over the weekend, and it's marvelous television. And great acting, by the way, including in the first episode, a wonderful performance of the prosecutor by Jack Klugman, who shows why he's one of the great television actors of all time. Could do comedy, drama, anything with a magnificent flair, and always had this sense of being the typical urban person. Just really wonderful. He also figures in one of the best episodes of the series, playing the criminal, or the alleged criminal, Blacklist. Really, really outstanding. Anyway, which won itself an Emmy Award for its writing and directing. The Defenders, one of the classics of 1960s television and classics of all time, now available at the first season on YouTube. Just go to YouTube.com, put in The Defenders, and the episode number, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., and I promise you, once you see this show, you will be hooked. It definitely is a show to know, a classic show to know. Is there a show to know right now that's running that you think deserves more attention isn't getting it? Well, let me know, and we will give it the attention, and we'll give you the credit for it. All you have to do is email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. You can also find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, post the information there, and we'll get right on the case. We want to hear from you because this is your show and what you say. So let us know, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember, that's also how you get involved in our Class Trivia Question of the Week. And if you know the answer, again, use that wonderful email. Don't forget to put down your name and your mailing address when you answer the question. And guess what? You could win Lucille Ball FAQ. Again, if you missed the question in the last half hour, just check out my Facebook page tomorrow morning or my Twitter page at UBCSimonTWBT. When we come back, we will have live the creator, executive director of one of the innovative series returning now on Netflix, Chef's Table. David Gelb joins me live from Los Angeles, and once again we'll have the main story of the day, the passing of Turner Classic Movies host Robert Osborne. It's all in a half hour ahead, and it begins after we pause at the top of this hour for web identification. You are connected to www.blogtalkradio.com with the 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your own for the Rappy Hour. Join Jordan Carhart. He talks about all things reality television, unscripted, and maybe even, well, who knows. Check him out weekends, various times, every week right here on Blog Talk Radio. The Rappy Hour with Jordan Carhar. And remember, you can catch his program and other BTR shows 24/7 at YouTube.com. You can catch our program and others as well on Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. If you don't have Apple TV, go to Apple Store near you or order it online. Welcome back to the Bobby Televised this Monday afternoon of March 2017. And welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Applebaum will be live from New York, 41 degrees outside. And we invite you to stick with us. We have a great guest coming your way this half hour ahead. And we invite you, as always, to be part of the program All About Television. All you have to do, raise your voice and dial in at 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio. You can also use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. In case you missed the top of the show last hour, we began with a very sad news note. Robert Osborne, the veteran journalist of Hollywood Activity, who became the primetime host of Cherry Factory Movies, has passed away. He was 84 and had taken a leave of absence from TCM last year to deal with an undisclosed health matter. Again, at the top of the hour, we do not know the cause of his death. Before TCM began in 1994, Osborne was host of the movie channel, the Showtime Sister Pay Network. He was also on the morning program, which ran about a year and a half during the mid-1980s on CBS, hosted by Mary Harvey and Robin Smith. And he also was a long-running rambling columnist at The Hollywood Reporter. In a statement released 2 hours ago, TCM General Manager Jennifer Dornan labeled Osborne's work, and I quote, fundamental in shaping TCM into what it is today, and we owe him a debt of gratitude that can never be repaid, unquote. I will have more about Osborne's wonderful career near the end of this half hour and this program. In case you joined us late, we have a theme with today's episode. It's all about return. Either a host returning to a show, as is the case with Jason Silva, our first guest, going from Brain Games to the new National Geographic program Origins, which premieres tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, or last half hour, the return of actor Robbie Coltrane to series television in National Treasure that has been running for the last 2 weeks on Hulu through smart TVs and smart TV sets. Well, for our final guest, it's all about the return of a series that's been critical acclaim since it started 3 years ago on Netflix. It's called Chef's Table, and it is a very groundbreaking look into the world of cuisine and the people who make it. Again, it is available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices that carry Netflix 24/7. Joining me live in an internet radio exclusive from Los Angeles, creator, executive producer, and director, David Gelb. David, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
David, how do you think this series has broken ground in how we see food on television?
You know, our goal in making Chef's Table is to tell inspiring personal stories of the chef's lives. And so rather than trying to teach the audience how to cook, we're really looking at why the chefs cook and telling their origin stories in an emotional way. So it's sort of like a biographical kind of show about creative people.
I noticed on Food Network and other networks that carry competitions like Chopped or Guy's Grocery Games on last night, we now hear more and more about the backstory of these chefs, how these chefs came to be, who they're playing for, the haphazard sometimes situations they come up with in life that they have to deal with or their families deal with. It sounds like Chef's Table really takes that all the way.
Well, I would say so. And, you know, Chef's Table started with a film I made called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And in the process of making that film, you know, I discovered that it's much more interesting to tell a story about a person or a family rather than just trying to give information about a subject. So, you know, we found that the emotional context, the story behind the food, is what makes it interesting and even more delicious to someone who's eating it or learning about it. So, you know, I think that's I think it's the right thing for those things too, because especially for a show like Chopped, where it's dramatic, people are being eliminated, you want to know what's at stake personally for them. And so that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, on Chef's Table, we're telling human stories, and it's really just about the people, and it's set in the world of food.
How do you determine who gets on Chef's Table? What about their life What about the way they treat their food, no matter what the cuisine is, no matter what country they come from? What has you say this is a subject to follow?
You know, our show is really, it requires the chefs to tell their own story. And so, you know, the first thing we look for is, in their food, are they telling a story? You know, what are the emotional cues, the things in their lives that affect their cuisine? We also are looking for chefs that are doing things that haven't been done before or are breaking through barriers or have been told no a million times and then finally succeeded. The sort of underdog stories are very attractive to us. And, you know, so those are the kind of things that inspire us. The hardest part of the show is choosing our chefs because there are so many chefs who are worthy of it, but, you know, worthy of having interesting films about them made. But, you know, we're looking for chefs who are willing to share intimate and emotional details of their lives, because that's really what our show is all about. It's trying to figure out, what is that spark? Was it something in their childhood, or what are the lessons that they've learned, both in failure and success? And usually it's failure that leads to success, that leads them to be great. And so we need chefs who are willing to share that. And, you know, it's not an easy thing to be interviewed for over the course of 10 days. We'll do 8 hours of interviews with a chef, and they really have to dig deep in order for the show to be successful. And so, you know, we're really grateful that the chefs that we've chosen have been willing to do that. And, you know, that's kind of the core of the show, I would say.
So once you pick a chef who is willing to share their lives, both on and off the restaurant or on and off their cuisine with you and
mm-hmm.
your production
mm-hmm.
team, A, how long do you spend with them? And B, do you sort of, when you question them, because they are telling their story, do you decide,
mm-hmm.
all right, this is the starting point, and then as we get more and more into what they do day to day, who they deal with, how they deal with the food, then we can go for the more sensitive material or for the more, you know, to really, you know, what may be the ultra-sensitive point for them to talk about, the toughest thing to talk about?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our approach is one of collaboration between the director and the chef. So we start out by doing a lot of research before we even talk to the chef for the first time. And then at that point, you know, the chefs understand that we've done our homework and we want to make a show with them. And so essentially the chef and the director, with the guidance of the producers, will then prepare kind of a schedule or an outline of what it is that we're going to film. We like to start out with an interview early, and you know, the first interview, like you're saying, you know, we start out kind of asking questions that are not too invasive because we need to build a relationship with our chef. And so, you know, we'll ask the basic questions first, a lot of stuff about their cuisine, their cooking. And, you know, the chefs also, a lot of these chefs have been interviewed many times and they have their kind of stock stories or they have their stories that they normally tell. And so we let them tell all those stories. By the time we get to the second interview later in the week, we've really built a relationship and kind of are now able to ask the more difficult questions. And, you know, that's something that the chefs kind of welcome. And we find that by the end of the story, we don't need to dig too hard. They're more than willing to share these things because we've built this relationship and they understand that we're going to treat their story with the dignity and respect that it deserves.
How much research do you do?
I mean, quite a bit. In the cases where the chefs have written books or there are lots of art, if they're famous, then we've read everything that they've done prior to starting and everything that's been written about them. For the chefs that are not as famous and haven't been written about as much, we'll do a number of preliminary interviews to try to get a sense of, you know, what their story is and what it is that we can film that will be appropriate visuals to match with the telling of their story. And, you know, but every chef is different. But we will read every piece of writing about any chef that's available.
David Gelb is the creator, executive producer, and often director of Chef's Table. It's now in season 3 on Netflix, available on most smart TV sets and most smart devices, and winning critical acclaim all over the place. David joins us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Now, more than midway through its 10th season as the program All About Television. So I'm Applebaum with you live from the other coast, New York, where it's 41 degrees at the top of the hour. You have a question or comment for David. Don't be shy. Get on the menu with us and use this number, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. David, in a way, are you surprised that this was on Netflix rather than Food Network? Well, one would think that maybe to an outsider that food would have loved to take on this kind of a program.
Well, you know, the initial instinct was that, you know, we would love to have had this on Food Network because this is a food show. However, the style of the show is quite different from things that had been done in the food world before, in that it's not a competition. We don't have a celebrity or beloved host that is consistent through each of the episodes kind of guiding the audience through. We're really taking the approach of being a serious documentary. And, you know, to be honest, when we were first starting, a number of agents and production heads at production companies indicated to me that it's not possible to produce a show like Chef's Table, where each episode is a miniature documentary of a chef. And, you know, it isn't particularly it doesn't really fit in with normal reality television in that, you know, we're using prime lenses. We're not zooming in and out. We don't use, you know, kind of rock and roll, kind of exciting music. You know, we're trying to treat the films with a real cinematic treatment. And it just didn't exist. And so, you know, Netflix, fortunately, had a lot of success on their Zero Dreams of Sushi. And so with that as a precedent, I was able to convince them with, you know, my fellow producers that, you know, there could be a show like this in the food space that's completely different. And so they were willing to take a risk.
And a good risk it was, too. This year, you have six chefs that are profiled, and they come from really amazing locations. You've got a chef from South Korea. You have a chef from Russia, one from Germany, one here, right here in New York, by the way, named Ivan Orkin, who runs restaurants of the same name, one in L.A., and one from Lima, Peru. Is this the most globe-trotting season yet?
You know, I think so. You know, we try to travel quite a bit for each season. In this season, what we've found is that it's a bit of a departure from previous seasons in that not all of the restaurants featured are extremely expensive or exclusive. In the case of Ivan Orkin in New York, you can go into Ivan Ramen on Clinton Street or their Slurp Shop at the Gotham Market, and you can have a full meal there for $20. And, you know, there's just as much kind of care and dedication and a story behind the dishes that he's making as there are at the three-star Michelin $300-a-person restaurant. And so, you know, we try not only to expand geographically globally, but also to expand in the breadth of the type of restaurants that we're featuring. And, you know, our show is not exclusively made for restaurants that are only available to the super rich. For example, Jung Kwon, a Korean Buddhist nun, doesn't even have a restaurant. And, you know, she's really just a teacher and an inspiration to a lot of chefs around the world. And so, you know, our show is just trying to, you know, we're just trying to move it forward and democratize it and tell stories about restaurants that can be
accessed. Go back to that person you just mentioned. What about her and what she does inspiring people?
Well, Jung Kwon is a unique chef in that she practices Buddhist temple food. And in the Korean style. And temple food, it's vegan food, and it's designed to kind of create energy and thoughts and to support meditation. And so it's an interesting cuisine because, you know, the Buddhism is all about kind of awareness. And it's a, you know, they don't want you to feel these feelings of greed or lust for food that you may feel in other restaurants. And so ingredients like garlic, chives, onions, anything in that family is actually prohibited in temple food. But to flavor the food, instead of using garlic, you know, which they consider to be kind of an addictive flavor, you know, they'll use fermentation. So Jung Kwon, she's now in her 60s. She is using techniques of Buddhist cooking that have been passed down to her through the generations where she ferments things. She puts them in pots underground and creates things like kimchi, all different types of vegetables and sauces that are fermented, and they have an incredible flavor beyond what we conventionally use when we're cooking. And so this has really inspired chefs like Eric Repair and Renee Redzepi, who have said that, you know, she is a brilliant chef, bringing a lot of very interesting ideas. And her food is truly delicious. It's really something else, and you feel amazing after you eat it. And, you know, I myself am a major carnivore. You know, I love to eat meat. So I thought I'd challenge myself by directing this episode on my own. I thought, you know, well, I'll go and take the challenge of eating vegan food, which, you know, I don't think I'd ever had a vegan meal in my life before this. I was stunned by how delicious the food was and how, but I was so moved by how wonderful a person Jung Kwon is and how inspiring she is and her kind of her one of the things that she likes to say is that, you know, that ego gets in the way of creativity, and that great artists are, they produce beautiful work despite their ego and not because of it. And, you know, in many of our episodes, you know, she deals with these problems of ego and wanting to be the best. And she has a very interesting take on it. So I really suggest that people watch that episode, episode one of season three of Chef's Table, now on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned Chopped before, and one of the most unique episodes that series has had, and I talked with Ted David, the host of Chopped, last year about it, and it's still, it's a haunting episode, and it's also a very moving episode. It's about the lunch ladies. It was presented on the week of Thanksgiving, about 4 years ago, and it deals with people, all the contestants were chefs at school cafeterias who, they got on the air, were saying, we don't get the respect from the schools, from the kids, from our contemporaries, people just take us for granted, et cetera, et cetera. And thank God there was this network and this show that treats us like equals and gives us an opportunity not only to be exposed for what we provide for kids, but also to show that we're creative. We don't just do like what we're told, you know, the menu of the day. And to see them, it was so moving. They were themselves moved, and I can tell you from talking to Ted David, there was no dry eye in the studio, not one, because everybody, judges, all the contestants, Ted, was just like so moved by seeing these people be so thankful that they had television as an exposure to do it. I'm wondering if in your journey doing this series, you found any chefs that, you know, expressed like, thank you for showing me. Thank you for showing what I do, because sometimes I feel like I'm not worthy or I'm undeserved or I'm underappreciated. People don't understand me, don't get my cuisine, don't get how I do my work.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that sounds like a really fascinating episode, and I want to watch that. You know, I think that, you know, this is an issue that many artists face where, you know, they feel like they're struggling and they're working hard and nobody's really showing them appreciation. And, you know, in our show, we do episodes on chefs of different levels of fame. So, you know, a number of the chefs that we film have already experienced a lot of recognition and, you know, that's how we found them. But some of our chefs have not. And, you know, one comes to mind in particular, Nikki Nakayama of the restaurant En Naka in Los Angeles. And, you know, she was really not known outside of California. And, you know, she's been working really hard kind of making this beautiful, locally inspired kaiseki cuisine and kind of, you know, doing it in a way where, you know, and there's a stigma in Japan and amongst Japanese cuisine that, you know, women should not be chefs. They shouldn't be sushi chefs. They shouldn't be kaiseki chefs. And so, you know, she kind of struggled with that with the when she opened a sushi restaurant and she would have Japanese clients and, you know, they would kind of have a problem with a woman making sushi, which I think is ridiculous. I think that women, of course, can make just as wonderful sushi as men can. And so, you know, I think that she appreciated being able to kind of story on Chef's Table. And so, you know, I think a lot of our chefs have stories they want to tell. We never want to tell a story that they have, you know, we want to tell stories in ways that are different from the way it's been told before. And so, when we're able to shine a spotlight on someone like Nikki Nakayama, or even for some of our more famous chefs, where we're able to talk about issues that are important to them, or the fact that they felt, you know, disrespected as artists, you know, we relish that, and we want to shine a light on chefs who may not be getting the recognition, but certainly deserve it.
David, the chefs that you showcase in all three seasons, do they see what they do as a face? Or as a relationship unto itself, especially when they're dealing with an unfortunate circumstance or tragic circumstance in either their lives or lives of people they know?
You know, I think that it's different in every case. You know, I think a lot of the chefs are just doing what they feel they have to do. You know, so in a way they feel like it's out of their control. And I think it's the case with many artists, is that they are simply doing what they feel like they must. You know, I think that's a great thing that you brought up, and it makes me think of Ivan Orkin's episode. You know, and Ivan is somebody who, you know, was kind of, you know, he was living in New York, and he was working at some of the best restaurants in New York, and then, you know, he was working for a restaurant, kind of a a chef kind of management company, you know, for kind of a corporate chef kind of gig. And, you know, a tragedy affected him. You know, he felt it. You know, his wife died and he had a 2-year-old kid. And, you know, that changes your life. And that set him on a path that led him to become a wonderful chef. But he didn't do it. So I don't think that it was like a conscious decision where he's like, oh, this horrible thing happened to me. I'm now going to try to become the best ramen chef in the world. You know, it's a series of events. It's a path that you take, and that a major event can spur you in that direction. But the rest of it is sort of like fate. You know, I think that the things that Ivan has done and are remarkable. And, you know, I'm incredibly proud of his episode. But, you know, I think that these things, he's just living his life, and he's trying to do what he can. He's trying to do what he can. And, you know, just as that happens, that based on the way that he is and the things that happened to him, it took him on this incredible journey. And, you know, his journey is still going on. In fact, Ivan just opened up a new pizza place at the Gotham Market that I really think that people should try. It's called the Corner Slice, and it looks awesome. But, you know, he never suspected that he'd be doing these amazing things when he was a kid, I don't think. And, you know, it's amazing how these things happen.
Chef's Table is now in its third season on Netflix, one of the most popular unscripted shows on that service, available on smart TV sets and smart devices from Roku to Apple TV to Google Chromecast. We have David Gelb, the creator, executive producer, and sometimes director of the series, for a few more minutes, live from Los Angeles here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum, live with you from New York. If you have a question or comment, get it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Don't know who our guests will be on our next episode Friday at this very time, 3 to 4, 4:30 p.m. Eastern. That's noon to 1:30 Pacific on Blog Talk Radio. We are hoping to have Leslie Grief, the executive producer of Sun Records, which is a critically acclaimed miniseries directed by Roland Joffe, is now running Thursday night after Nashville on TNT. So check us out on Facebook, check us out on Twitter to find out who our guests will be this coming Friday afternoon. We're seeing more and more shows that deal with talented kids and talented teenagers in a wide variety of skills, whether entertainment or cooking. Any thoughts about maybe devoting an episode of Chef's Table to a talented teenager or a talented child who is, you know, is really showing great skill in cooking?
You know, I think that it's difficult to do something like that, because when you have a talented child, you know, their story is really just beginning. And so, you know, even though they are maybe incredibly talented and are doing amazing things at a younger than normal age, you know, our show is about a life. It's about a life in pursuit of something. And so, you know, I'm not sure if it lends itself to our format, but it seems like the great first chapter of a wonderful Chef's Table story. So, you know, when you see kind of these wunderkind chefs, you know, we're curious what's going to happen to them. And so, you know, we keep our eyes on them, but, you know, I don't think that it, I'm not sure that our format will really work with someone, you know, under the age of like 30, for example, just because there's just so much life ahead of them, you know, and that's really the story. Is our stories are not just about, you know, someone who is a genius and is able to just make something. It's really about the journey to realize a creative, you know, a creative vision. So it's more than just talent. You know, if you look at it like a superhero story, you know, Spider-Man's story just begins when he gets bitten by the radioactive spider and he realizes that he has these powers. But it's through, you know, a journey of trying to figure out how to use those powers for good. You know, he uses his powers in all the wrong ways. And so only through those failures does he really realize how to, you know, kind of create his masterpiece. I guess Spider-Man isn't an artist, but you know what I mean. Crime-fighting artist. You know, that's kind of how we look at it. It's a long journey. And so our story is really about it's a life in pursuit of an artistic dream.
If you haven't seen Chef's Table, you are in for a wonderful ride with some chefs who are worth hearing and finding out about, not just the food, but their lives. Chef's Table is available 24/7 on Netflix. Now it's third season, which started a few weeks ago, and you can get Netflix on most smart TV sets and most smart TV devices, including Roku, Apple TV, Google Chromecast, NVIDIA Shield, Amazon Fire TV, etc., etc. For more info, look for them online. For the Netflix website, that's Netflix.com, Netflix.com. David Gelb, creator, executive producer, director of Chef's Table, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on your series. Happy to see it go a third season. Hopefully many, many more to come. It's been a pleasure to have you on this half hour.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on your show, and I really appreciate what you do. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome, David. Take care. All the greatest. David Gelb, live in Los Angeles here on Tomorrow Be Televised. David was just talking about people who have a life in pursuit, and that certainly was Robert Osborne, who passed away earlier today at the age of 84. Whether it was his pursuit of all things Hollywood as a columnist for Hollywood Reporter, or whether it was his hosting, educating us all about great films, or even underrated movies, first with the Movie Channel and then so memorably on Turner Classic Movies, he was the one. And he did it brilliantly with a lot of class, a lot of style, not with a lot of flair, just with great facts, great knowledge, a lot of it improvised off the cuff. But no matter where he was, in front of the camera at the Turner Classic Movie Studios in Atlanta, whether it was on the TCM Classic Cruise or the annual TCM Classic Film Festival that takes place next month, he was always there, always great being with people. I did have a chance to see him in action a couple of years ago when he launched the TCM bus tour here in New York. It was a great tour of landmarks. I didn't get a chance to talk with him, but I did even talk with the likes of Jane Powell, other great fans of the network, and he was just always kind, considerate, just terrific. I wish I could have had a chance to know him, either from his Hollywood Reporter days or on the morning program or on his other work. But one thing was for sure, nobody educated more people at one time about great movies and movies you should see than Robert Osborne. He will be very, very much missed. There will never be a host like him. And I'm happy that he spent a lot of his time from the get-go with Turner Classic Movies, almost to the end of his life, showing us all what great hosting in front of a camera is all about. Robert Osborne passed away earlier today at the age of 84. He leaves behind his family and the millions who was his other family on Turner Classic Movies. I'm sure that TCM will do a special retrospective at some point before the end of the week, and I hope that there'll be a big tribute to him down the road. Once again, Robert Osborne, dead at the age of 84. Rest in peace, Robert. You did a marvelous job, one of the very best in your craft, no one like you, and that's just the fact. We'll be back on Friday with more great guests and more about the world of television, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific here on Blog Talk Radio. If you came in late on today's episode, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version on iTunes.com. You can download it to your smartphone or tablet, take us on the go, share it with others, feel that love with others too. And remember, we're also available where you can watch and hear us on Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. It's Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. If you don't have Apple TV, go to an Apple store near you or order it online. What do we have our guest today and our whole theme of return? What do you think about where TV is at and where it's going? Content, technology, services, et cetera, et cetera. We'd love to hear from you, so let your voice know and be known. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. It's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. You can also find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. Remember, we appreciate what you have to say because what you say matters. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Toews, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, the creator of this enterprise, Mr. Alan Levy. Tomorrow We Tell Live was brought to you today by Audible.com, an Amazon company. Again, for a 30-day trial, one free audiobook, audibletrial.com/televised. For Tomorrow We Tell Live, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. We're back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. You know where. Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned. And rest in peace, Robert.